This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
Bail is refused.
You're out of order!
If it pleases the court.
To adopt this affirmation, please say the words, I do.
I do.
Nothing further from this court.
Given the serious nature of this offence,
this case is dismissed.
Welcome to The Wigs. I'm your host, Jim Minns. In this episode, recorded on the 19th of December 2023, The Wigs analyse the decision of the High Court in NZYQ versus Minister for Immigration 2023 HCA 37, one of the most important public law decisions in recent decades, and which was handed down on the 28th of November 2023. In the decision, the court unanimously overturned an earlier decision in Al-Kateb and held that long-standing constitutional principles forbids indefinite detention of non-citizens who cannot be removed from Australia. The judgment has been massively controversial, and the Federal Parliament legislated in December last year in response to it to create a system of monitoring and regulation applying to those persons affected directly by the decision. We do apologise for the delay in releasing this episode, but we hope it's still an interesting and useful discussion of one of the most important principles in Australian constitutional law, that detention is prima facie punitive and can generally only be imposed by a court following an adjudication of guilt. And just a reminder that listening to The Wigs counts for continuing professional development points, so if you need some more points before the 31 March deadline, The Wigs are here for you with this episode on substantive law and a whole back catalogue of great content.
Introductions. Emmanuel Kirkasharian, starting with you today.
Jim Minns.
I learned my lesson.
You did.
Yep, going in that order.
So nice to be here in this office that
we're
in.
Welcome back to the office, yeah.
Thank
old
you.
School.
Yeah.
The shed years are back.
Yeah.
Felicity Graham, welcome to The Wigs.
Thanks, Jim Minns. So good to be here.
So good to have you here. You're very welcome for the
introduction. In this house of justice and truth.
Yep.
Fairness.
Sort of.
Truth. Yes. Let's talk about truth. Stephen Lawrence.
Anyone's ever called it that before.
Well,
yes.
Welcome to, this is your office, Stephen
Lawrence.
It's
really good to have you all here. I hope you like what I've done with it.
It's lovely.
Mm.
It looks like a real parliamentary office.
Yeah, good.
We've got a lot to discuss. What are we doing? One topic, two topics? What was
probably
the?
Two.
I wasn't here for the pre-meeting discussion.
Let's see how we go.
Let's go. Okay. We'll start with me.
Okay, we are doing a topic led by Emmanuel Kirkasharian.
What is it, Jim? What is it?
I wasn't here for the pre-meeting.
Just give us a summary. Come on.
I'll leave that to the experts.
NZYQ.
Of course.
Which is not that person's initials. And the Minister for Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs, 2023 High Court of Australia 37, is our topic for the day. NZYQ is a decision about the immigration law that applies to people who aren't citizens, who are facing deportation, but the government can't find a country that is willing to take them. It's worth starting with another case in 2004 called Al-Kateb and Godwin, 2004-219-CLR-562, which was, until this case, the case that sort of set out the law of what happens in this situation. Al-Kateb was a refugee. He was born in Kuwait. He wasn't a citizen of Kuwait, though. He came to Australia.
He was Palestinian, wasn't he?
I think that's right. He was denied a refugee visa. He was detained and no country would take him back. Al-Kateb applied for habeas corpus and mandamus, so one, habeas corpus to produce his body to effectively set him free, and in the alternative, mandamus to force them to take him to another country. And that gave rise to two issues. One was a construction issue about the terms of the Migration Act, and the other one was a constitutional issue. Does indefinite detention, which is what somebody who can't be deported because no place will take them can find themselves in, does that infringe the Chapter 3 of the Constitution? Can the executive indefinitely detain somebody? Now, it was a 4-3 majority decision that basically said, yes, you can.
I remember this in admin law.
Yeah, it was a really interesting case, and it divided across lines that you might not think. So Justices Hayne, Callanan, Hayden and McHugh were upheld the right to indefinite detention, whereas Chief Justice Gleeson, Gummow and Kirby were in the dissent in that case. Gleeson said in dissent that in interpreting legislation, the courts do not impute the legislature an intention to abrogate or curtail certain human rights or freedoms of which personal liberty is the most basic, unless such an intention is clearly manifested by unambiguous language. And so Gleeson kicked it out on statutory interpretations grounds without sort of going to the constitutional ground. McHugh sort of said that immigration detention wasn't punitive, and so he basically said that, you know, if it's not punitive, then it's not a type of detention that infringes Chapter 3, and on that basis said that it was constitutional.
So what was the statutory interpretation argument in Al-Khattab? It was about whether the provision that says an unlawful citizen must be detained and then removed as soon as practicable, about whether you being a person who is indefinitely detained because they can't find a place to send you or because non-refoulement obligations apply is still a person being detained for the purpose of removal, even though the detention's indefinite. That was sort of the argument, wasn't it?
Yeah. And so what Chief Justice Gleeson said, the statutory interpretation point, was basically, look, if the Parliament wants to give you the power to do it indefinitely, they can do that, but they've got to do it, right?
Yeah.
And so they didn't, right? Somewhat tragically, I think, this is sort of apocryphal more than anything else, but it's said that the reason why McHugh joined the majority in upholding the legislation was because he thought that it would kickstart a real push for a Bill of Rights in Australia. And around that time, there was that sort of discussion going on, and unfortunately that didn't go anywhere. Anyway.
Can I just ask, is Al-Khattab out now?
Yeah. Oh, no, out. Yeah, yeah. He was, as I understand it, he was released not that long after that decision. As in, it might have been years, but that's my understanding. He was released into the community. On some
discretionary basis.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think he got a visa eventually.
Mm. Yeah. So there'd been a few attempts to reopen Al-Khattab. I think there was one or two where they had a pretty good case to run, and very quickly the immigration department or the minister sort of let the person go or did something to sort of frustrate those cases being run. But we come to NZYQ. He's a Rohingya from Myanmar. He's about 28 or 30 years old. He arrives in Australia in September 2012. In 2014, he's given a bridging visa and released from immigration detention. On the 9th of January 2015, he was charged with sexual intercourse with a person between age 10 and 14, which had occurred earlier that day. 7 days later, his visa was cancelled. He's pleaded guilty, sentenced to 5 years with 3 years and 4 months on the bottom in August 2016. In May 2018, he's released on parole but goes straight into immigration detention because he doesn't have a visa. And there's a whole bunch, and I won't recount them, of immigration decisions and actions that are taken after that time. But the long and short of it is from May 2018, he finds himself in immigration detention without a country that's willing to take him. It's worth noting that the immigration department has never been able to remove a stateless person convicted of sexual offending against a child, which is the category that he fell in. There appeared to be some factual argument in the High Court about the prospects of his removal. There was some attempt to get the Americans, to take him. But, you know, that
very
really...
Very odd, that last-ditch attempt, wasn't it? I mean, even if they could, in the circumstance of that particular case, with this litigation on foot and maybe not looking that good for them, secure the agreement of the Americans to send this sex offender there, it would hardly resolve the ultimate issue, right?
Yeah.
And so you would then have what, under this theory, the case falls over because he's allowed to go to America, and then you have undetermined the constitutionality of the detention of hundreds of people until the next person sort of gets their shit together and gets to the High Court. I mean, it's would have been a pretty unsatisfactory way to resolve it, I would have thought.
Although not from the Commonwealth's perspective, where the longer Al-Khattab remains entrenched, the harder it is for the High Court to overrule it, right?
But if it's going to go, it's going to go, right? And there's no change in the High Court numbers in terms of the personnel on the High Court for years now.
Yeah, well, that's true.
So if they're of that view, they're of that view, right? So to defeat the case that way, I think that would have been pretty reckless in terms of the Commonwealth's liabilities.
Yeah.
Because unless they legislate, these people are going to have big civil claims.
Yeah, and well, query whether they can legislate because of the just terms property clause of the Constitution, right? I don't know that. I don't know actually whether the Commonwealth can extinguish what effectively it chose as an action.
Tortious liability,
right?
Yeah, I think they can, but that's interesting.
Yeah. So, well, pre-existing ones as opposed to future ones, right? Anyway, so, I mean, the arguments, I don't know how much time I want to spend on the arguments, but, you know, there was this great case called Lim, which was a pretty staunch sort of statement that really punishment and detention was for the courts.
Yeah.
That has been whittled away over the years, including in Altered, but also in other spaces like in high-risk offender detention and that kind of thing. But basically the argument that was made was that both the statutory interpretation point and the constitutional point should be overruled. Altered should be overruled. They faced it squarely. And what the High Court said is, look, we're going to leave the statutory interpretation point alone, but we're going to overrule the constitutional point. Yeah. And they did it in a very interesting judgment because it's a joint judgment by all the members of the court. But interestingly, there's a sort of bit where they discuss what Justice Edelman would have done if he'd been writing his own judgment.
Out on his own.
I thought that was interesting.
It's like a composite, joint, seen that before. Separate judgment scenario.
Now, I wondered that I don't know whether I'm making this up, but somebody told me that there was a sort of thing that the High Court did when somebody delivered their first judgment as a judge of the High Court. And, of course, Justice Betch Jones was – this is, I think, his first judgment. Yeah. He was on his first judgment. Where they let that judge write the judgment and they all support – they all kind of jumped on the back of it. So I don't know whether that was the catalyst or whether it was just – we also have a new Chief Justice, of course, and it may be that it's the new Chief Justice sort of – making a statement about this is we're going to try and establish unanimity, particularly in these quite powerful constitutional cases. I really don't know whether I like it or not. I'm genuinely in two minds about it. In the one hand, it's really nice to have this kind of this is what the court says and this is how the dissent would fit into it. On the other hand, I kind of like – I hate a million kind of judgments, but I do like the idea of having a core judgment and a dissent that sets out I disagree in this way, but it is interesting, and my suspicion is we might see more of it with Justice Chief Justice Gaedler now.
I mean, you see quite commonly in the New South Wales Court of Appeal or Court of Criminal Appeal, I agree with the orders and reasons of Justice so and so, except for this point, and I give my reasons why. Blah.
But you just don't see it in the same judgment.
No, that's right.
Yeah, like Justice Bell had a different view. Their view was this. You don't really see that. Normally there's Justice Bell's judgment.
Yeah.
I thought
so it was kind of
about the constitutional sort of issue, do you think, in terms of the separation of powers stuff? Like that was basically the issue, wasn't it?
That's the issue, right?
That Lim says that detention, unless proved otherwise, is by default judicial, basically.
Yeah.
And there's these long recognised exceptions to that. So detention for the purpose of removal, detention for the purpose of public health, detention for the purpose of mental health issues or whatever. And yeah, in this case, there's that default presumption. And then it would have been necessary for the Commonwealth to show that it's not punitive. And they get into this argument, I suppose, again, that came up in that Alexander case that I did about what are the purposes of punishment, what's the purpose of the criminal justice system, and basically to indefinitely detain someone, to separate them from the community, that's punitive, seems to be the conclusion. And therefore separation of powers is breached because it's an executive officer who's detaining them.
Which I think is good. I mean, that's fundamental Chapter 3 stuff because otherwise you're locking people up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're trying to stop here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the interesting points in this that came out in the course of the argument in front of the High Court was that is there a distinction between what the common law says you can do with a citizen and what you can do with an alien? And obviously there are powers that relate to immigration and so on, but this is Lenehan in the High Court, and I don't know where he's quoting from, but he says this: the common law of Australia knows no lettre de cache, my French is horrible, or executive warrant pursuant to which either citizen or alien can be deprived of his freedom by mere administrative decision or action. And I think, and it goes on to say, it cannot be too strongly stressed that these basic matters are not the stuff of empty rhetoric. They are the very fabric of the freedom under which the law is prima facie, under the law which is prima facie the right of every citizen and alien in the land. They represent a bulwark against tyranny. And I think that's important. I think you can't have the situation where we label people as aliens and somehow deny them rights that one might consider inalienable to all humans. Yeah. And executive detention, I think, falls into that category.
So the argument that seemed to emerge maybe in the argument of the matter as the determinative issue on reading the judgment was, is the separation of the alien from the general community until they're removed a non-punitive purpose?
Mm.
And the High Court basically said, no. We don't recognise that as the purpose of the detention. The purpose of the detention is to get them out of Australia. Once that can't be achieved on an indefinite basis, then there's not some other legitimate purpose, which is the separation of them from the community.
Yeah.
So then you're just left with the conclusion that it's punitive because it's based on the fact of a criminal conviction or some other view that's been formed about their risk of offending. It's indefinite and therefore it's punitive.
Yeah.
That seems to be the guts of it.
And that feeds into, and we'll come to this in a minute, but I don't want to go there right now, that feeds into these orders that they're now proposing or that are now on the books, which purport to permit courts to lock people up.
Yeah.
Because they pose a risk. But we'll come to that. Mm. Before we do, the one thing that's worth noting is that the court delivered its decision on the spot.
Mm. After 16 minutes.
They walked out the back and they said a majority of people, judges, agree with the orders that we're about to make. As it turns out, they all did. But
they've been criticised for that, right?
Well,
I mean, do you think that's a valid criticism?
No.
I don't really, because you're talking about someone's wrongful detention. But I mean, they came out and said at least a majority of the court considered that the detention of the plaintiff was unlawful. Yeah. Well, every day of liberty is precious.
Yeah.
I think you can't tolerate extending that detention if you've formed the view that it's unlawful.
But I think there's a question about whether they should or could have reasonably reached that conclusion without going on thinking about it. But I think the answer to that is this question of Al-Khateb and its correctness. It's been one of the big issues in constitutional law basically for the last two decades, that anyone who thinks about migration law has been pondering. There's been other cases that have raised it. This is something that would have been on their mind for a long time. They would have been thinking about this issue before this particular case was filed.
Sure.
So I'm not surprised at all that they were decisively able to make a decision on the spot, because it's probably something they already had a view about, really.
Also, the Commonwealth at the end of the argument basically said to the court, look, we want to be able to send, and I'm paraphrasing this badly, but we want to be able to send you new evidence if it comes up. So if, for example, if we become able to deport this man, we want to tell you that, because that will change fundamentally the outcome of the proceedings. And there's some discussion there about it actually being often the case in habeas cases for the judgment to, for the decision to be delivered on the spot, because it's a habeas case.
Yeah. That's right.
But also I wonder whether the High Court was concerned that the Commonwealth might frustrate
the giving of the decision
bringing an end to the matter.
By what, finding a place to send him.
Yeah.
Wonder whether that would have, I mean, unless somehow the case was withdrawn, but the question of whether he had been unlawfully detained, and presumably this was a tort case as well,
No, I don't think so. No. I mean, there might be a flow on, like there might be a subsequent case, but this wasn't a civil case.
This was a stated case, wasn't it? Yeah, just on the constitutionality.
That's right.
I mean, so, this wasn't a tort case, rather.
But it would still be relevant to determine, right? Because let's say they got him a visa to America and they go back to the court and say, we've got him a visa for America. Surely there is still a valid basis to deliver judgment on the question, because the point at which he became indefinitely detained, which is not retrospectively obviated by the fact that he's gotten a visa later, he's still been indefinitely detained for a period.
I'm not sure they saw the declaration, though. I have to check that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's an interesting question to see what the High Court would have done in that circumstance. The habeas would fall away because he wouldn't be in the custody of the Commonwealth.
Mm.
And then what does that leave? So maybe there's no matter left. I mean, I imagine the High Court would have been super pissed about it, but that's a whole other. And that's one of the interesting things about this case is, and the aftermath of it, which we'll come to now, is sort of the relationship between the executive and the parliament and the High Court. Because I think certainly probably since Mabo, this is the most stressed I've ever seen that relationship. You've got the immediate response from both sides of politics was sort of shock and horror at this decision. Within a few days of the ruling, prior to the decision being – the reasons being published, the federal government introduced legislation to deal with people in this category. It was rushed through parliament. I think it was received assent sort of days after – the Migration Amendment Bridging Visa Conditions Act 2023. Mm. And I'll come to what that says. And then after that, they introduced another bill and act and made another act that added for these control orders and provision to jail people.
Mm.
But the first thing they did was basically imposed monitoring conditions as mandatory on visas for people who fall into this category.
They basically changed the visa type, didn't they, in effect?
Yeah. In effect, they created a visa type for these, because these people otherwise didn't have visas.
It was sort of bridging visa pending removal, but where you can't practically be removed.
Yeah. So you had to report. You had this curfews, monitoring devices by way of ankle bracelets, they attending specific places, and created a series of offences for breaching those conditions with mandatory minimums.
Yeah, I really want to unpack this in a bit of detail.
Mm. Mandatory minimums of a year and 5 years max. So, for example, if you fail, let's not use the word forget because that imputes mental elements, but if you fail to report that your battery is running down, then you are on your ankle monitor. You are facing a mandatory minimum term of 12 months.
And potentially for some of the offences, the factual scenario could result in like a 7-year mandatory minimum if you fail to comply with whatever condition for a week, because each day that you fail to notify about which address you're at or comply with your curfew or whatever is a separate offence potentially.
Yeah.
Can I just say something about mandatory sentencing generally? Because I was looking at a case and I think maybe we'll do an episode on this some time down the track, but there's a really good Victorian Court of Appeal decision, Buckley and the Queen 2022 VSCA 138. It's a decision of President Maxwell and Justice Forrest. They were looking at some of the mandatory sentencing provisions in Victoria, including as they pertain in that particular case to quite a young person, 18 I think he was. But what they said in that case was mandatory minimum sentences are wrong in principle. They require judges to be instruments of injustice. To inflict more severe punishment than a proper application of sentencing principle could justify, to imprison when imprisonment is not warranted and may well be harmful, and to treat as identical offenders whose circumstances and culpability may be very different. Mandating imprisonment in this way must be seen to reflect the ascendancy of a punitive sentiment and a disregard of the demonstrated benefits of non-custodial orders and, in cases like the present, the vital importance of rehabilitating young offenders. And they go on to say, so this is at paragraphs 5 and 6, it also reveals a wholly unjustified mistrust of those on whom sentencing discretion is conferred. Sentencing courts are much better equipped and much better placed than legislators to determine what type and length of sentence will satisfy the sentencing objectives in a particular case. And there's some, there are some good authorities, I think, or good discussions in authorities in the Northern Territory as well around mandatory sentencing, because basically what the effect of it is, if the appropriate sentence is 2 years jail, well, the mandatory minimum of 1 year is going to fall away and 2 years is going to be imposed. But if the appropriate sentence applying sentencing principles is 6 months jail or a good behaviour bond or a fine or whatever, then the 1 year mandatory minimum is going to
excessive.
Yeah,
but it's not the appropriate
require mandatory. An excessive. No, how could it be?
No. I mean, the starting
in
point
most
is 1 year.
Cases,
Parliament has said your representatives, Felicity, people who represent you, have said that if somebody who's on one of these visas fails to report their battery, then the starting point is that they should do 12 months jail. And so any appropriate sentence starts with 12 months and goes up because, you know, if they didn't have a good excuse, maybe they should be doing 15 months on the bottom. And that's the way that our democracy has decided these people should be treated. Mm. Now, you know, I may disagree with that.
But I think we need to consider this as well, that in assessing what the appropriate sentence is, in the normal criminal law, you're looking at, like, the circumstances in which the offence was committed, mitigating, aggravating factors, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what the policy behind this act in reality is this is a person who's in the community in very extraordinary circumstances, who don't have a right of residence, are an alien, aren't a member of the political community. We're going to treat much more harshly any infraction of the criminal law from them.
Mm.
That's what the policy is, right?
Mm.
So I think, and you can sort of disagree with that or agree with that as a matter of policy choice, but that's the policy choice.
Mm.
So what is the appropriate sentence? I mean, obviously, this is mandatory sentencing, but what is the appropriate sentence sort of has to be assessed in that context of that legislative choice, doesn't it?
Mm. So as you mentioned, Steve, this is going to be challenged. So whether this counts as falling into the prism of being punitive and invalid under Chapter 3 of the Constitution is going to be tested. There's been litigation already commenced in the High Court challenging the imposition of the curfew and electronic monitoring conditions in
proceedings. So what would the argument be there, that it's punitive?
S151, AUK 15 and RVJB.
Yeah.
I think so, well, yeah.
But how does that breach separation of powers? Because of the... It's an executive function to put the visa condition.
That's right.
Yeah.
Hi, just cutting in here. After rushing through the federal legislation in the aftermath of NZYQ, three affected people brought High Court challenges against the Commonwealth's ankle bracelet and curfew regime. In early 2024, these cases were discontinued because the Australian government lifted the curfew and ankle monitoring device conditions on the plaintiffs, effectively scuttling their chance to obtain a court ruling on the regime.
What's the difference between curfew and jail? It's not all that much, right? Like, you're forcing someone to be at a premises for a significant period of that time of their life. What's the difference?
Mm. I mean, I think the difference is that under LIM, detention by default is judicial power.
Yeah.
So therefore, executive detention by default is unconstitutional unless it fits into a category.
And with the mandatory minimum,
this is not detention, but your point is it's something quite close to it.
Imagine the mandatory minimum,
the way that operates, like, it basically takes the decision making out of the court's hands.
I know, but mandatory sentencing challenges that mandatory sentencing is unconstitutional have consistently failed.
Mm.
And will fail.
But it's in a different context here, I suppose, but they have failed.
But
it's connected to this regime of imposing these wholly disproportionate, I think,
yeah,
visa conditions,
yeah,
on people who might not have any identifiable risk factors in the community. I think we need to kind of really make the point that the cohort of people who, about 140 people who've been released as a result of NZYQ, you know, fall into different categories in terms of...
I mean, I've represented some of these people.
Their past history.
A lot of them are not convicted child sex offenders.
Yeah.
Some of them I don't think even have convictions.
Yeah.
And some of them have convictions that, yeah, like they're relatively serious, but they're not in a cohort of people where you would conclude that they're a serious risk to the community at all.
Yeah, well, let's remember that we have...
There's AAT decisions people can look at that, you know, that relate to these people where their circumstances are exhaustively considered. I mean, these are people that some of them have served. I've acted for one of them. I mean, he did 18 months or something for a matter of
We did an episode
yeah. where we talked about this stuff. Yeah, they're not. Some are bad. There's no doubt about that. Sure. Some are the worst of the.
Okay.
Not, maybe but not the worst of the worst, but close to it. So many are not.
If they're in that high risk offender type cohort, there are state regimes and other regimes that could potentially be applied to them.
If they're in a very serious category.
Some of
yeah.
them.
Yeah,
some
if they're
them,
in a very yeah. serious category. And we have generally a system which says you only get locked up by a proper order of a court after a fair hearing, sentenced for a crime. And once you serve that sentence, you're entitled to be returned to liberty.
I don't think that's the case anymore.
Yeah.
I think that was once true, but I think if for the last 5 years, at least, if not 10 years, it has not been the case that for at least serious offenders, you can say really that they have a right to release at the end of their sentence.
Well, those because of the high-risk offender regimes that have been introduced, sure, but most people are entitled to their liberty at the end of their sentence.
But if you're saying by that that there should not be a particular regime to deal with these people, which might include preventative detention or other forms of monitoring, I don't necessarily agree with that, because the relevant circumstance that you must consider here is they are an alien without a legal right to be in Australia.
Mm.
And I just don't know that you can say, oh, well, we can't indefinitely detain you because of non-refoulement obligations or you're stateless, you know, no country will accept you. Therefore, even though you're not a member of the political community, we have no particular obligations to you positively. We're just going to release you into the community for as long as you want. You'll be treated like any other citizen. I wouldn't go that far. I think
be treated like any other citizen.
Well, if there was no other sort of regime to deal with, then they would be. I mean, they might not get Social Security and so forth, but they wouldn't be subject to any particular regime.
Mm.
I just think that's politically sustainable apart from anything else.
Commonly in the real world application of these types of regimes, how counterproductive they can be. And I don't know that kind of counterfactual has really been considered in the generation of this policy, because you can create criminals through this type of regime, and you can create then an environment in which people increase in their risk because of the way that you police them and curtail their behaviour and liberty in a way that really is unproductive, counterproductive.
What are the people who don't fall into the criminal category but find themselves in this space? Who are they? What's the characteristics of someone who's not, you know, the obvious one, a child sex offender, but some other sort of criminal thing?
So it's people who the minister has used those more general character cancellation or refusal provisions in respect of.
Yeah.
So there might be someone who is suspected of involvement in serious criminal activity, or suspected to be a risk of committing serious criminal activity, notwithstanding no prior convictions. So it might be, for example. I mean, there's specific provisions that deal with people that have been involved in foreign conflicts or crimes against humanity and stuff, but it might be someone speaking hypothetically, this isn't some case I know of, but someone who's come from a country that's had a horrible conflict, they had a position in a particular paramilitary organisation, there's intel that they've done certain things, but they can't charge them in Australia with anything. They wouldn't have the evidence, or there might not even be an applicable offence.
What are we talking, 100 people?
Yeah, I don't know how many are in that category of not having convictions, but yeah. My understanding is there's definitely some.
I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it, where, like, I agree that we can't – I don't think we should be letting – there has to be a class of unlawful non-citizens who we shouldn't let walk around the country without some sort of oversight. That has to exist.
Yeah, I think so.
How you deal with that, though – I don't know. I mean, you can make an argument for locking them up because you need some sort of deterrent effect to stop people from coming.
Mm. So this is the first time that a breach of a visa condition has been criminalised. Ordinarily, if you breach your visa condition, you can have your bridging visa cancelled and you go back into immigration detention, which is not a prison. It has very different conditions, although some very similar experiences in terms of, you know, mistreatment and being unsafe and so on. But it is a different creature.
But then you can't do that because these people can't be kept in immigration detention because they're not going to be returned.
Because the justification for not having the offence before was, well, the consequence is you lose your visa, you get removed.
Mm.
Because once you lose your visa under the normally applicable regime, you have to be removed.
Or you leave
as soon as possible.
Lose your visa pending determination of your ultimate visa application.
Yeah.
Except that these people don't have any such application that they can make.
Yeah.
So you're forced to imprison them.
Yeah.
Which I don't know. Which it actually of itself is a justification for the mandatory minimum. I hate to say, much as I detest mandatory
minimums. Why? Tease that up.
Well, because these people,
there's no other encouragement
for them to comply with what are strict visa conditions. We can argue about whether or not
because they're not going to be deported anyway.
Because they're not going to be deported anyway.
They can't be deported. They can't be deported. Detained.
So what's the point of putting them on a bond in those circumstances? They've shown themselves as unwilling to comply. The only thing we should do is jail them. Now, I'm not arguing that as someone who believes in that argument.
No,
but
it's a wicked problem, I think, is what that demonstrates.
Yeah.
The thing that I reckon is relevant about all of this as well is, so this legislation was developed pretty quickly in the aftermath of the High Court decision.
Mm.
But, you know, this problem has been a slow creation, mainly a slow creation from decisions of the previous coalition governments who did a series of things, obviously including mandatory cancellation provisions that dramatically increase the amount of people in immigration detention and the cancellation of a whole lot of permanent visas.
Mm.
But they also removed from, I don't know if it's section 199 or 200, but it's around there in the Migration Act, the section that says you must be removed as soon as practicable if you're an unlawful non-citizen. Mm. They removed from that international non-refoulement obligations. So it used to be you couldn't be removed under that section if the Commonwealth owed you non-refoulement obligation. So they removed that, right? Then there was that decision of AJL 20 by Bromberg that we
did an episode
on, where he said, well, if the Commonwealth's making an executive decision not to remove you because of international non-refoulement obligations, you're no longer validly detained under that section because you're not being detained for the purpose of removal.
Mm.
So sort of relying on Al-Khattab, right? Then the last government legislated to create this regime where you could be indefinitely detained if the Commonwealth owed you international non-refoulement obligations.
Mm.
So they've sort of slowly through really jacking up the numbers of people in detention, taking this very broad approach to cancellation, which doesn't really look at risk in individual circumstances, and then creating this category of people that they're choosing to detain indefinitely, they've kind of created this problem. And I don't know if we talked about this in AJL 20 episode or not, but I have definitely had discussions in the last couple of years where lawyers have basically said this is heading towards a preventative detention regime for these people because they're testing the kind of boundaries of the legitimate basis to detain, Alcatel will get revisited, and then there'll have to be a way to deal with these people.
It does represent an acceleration of a punitive approach to immigrants generally.
Question about that. If you look at the stats, the cancellations, it's just skyrocketed, particularly in 2013-14. There's no doubt about that. And a lot of it's not risk-based in the sense that we normally talk about in the criminal law. It's very broad. And a lot of these people have extensive connections to Australia. So
yeah, what about that woman that you were representing who was convicted of an accessory to a murder that didn't happen, and so but he got acquitted after she got convicted?
She's not that relevant to this discussion though, because she could be removed. In fact, she probably has been, I think, but because she was American.
Right.
So there was no indefinite detention issue. She was in detention for a long time because she was litigating.
But I guess just as an example of...
The punitive approach
and the approach not being risk-based.
Yeah, 100%.
Because she didn't represent any kind of meaningful risk. She didn't engage in any violence, did she?
Depending on how you sort of... Not in a direct sense. She was held to be complicit to a violent sort of offence.
Except that that person
as an accessory.
Was... acquitted on the basis of self-defense, weren't they?
Convicted of manslaughter on the basis of excessive
self-defense.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I think it would be fair comment on that case to say there was no
meaningful risk
to the Australian community. Yeah.
I think what this really shows is that when things become political footballs, when they become these big political issues, there seems to be this idea that the solution to problems is legislation and tough legislation.
And creating crimes.
Yeah, well, yeah, what better than to criminalise somebody to show your commitment to the protection of the community? But the real protection of the community in exceptional cases like this would be a properly functioning executive, right? There's 100 people here, so I'm making that number up, but let's say there's 100 people. Very quickly, a competent and informed immigration department or spook agency should be able to whittle that number down to 50 who need to be looked at and maybe 10 who need to be monitored in detail. And that can be done relatively cheaply by a group of spooks or agents who do that work.
Yeah.
And it can be done quietly and effectively. And instead what we have is a legislative hammer being swung to make political hay. And it's and both sides now implicated, I'm sorry to say.
But that's what I was getting at before, right, in the sense that an alternative way of dealing with this situation was for the previous government, for example, to create this kind of regime. So to say, with this cohort of people, even though maybe we can indefinitely detain them because Alcatel says we can, we're not going to. We're going to create supervision regimes, we're going to create offences for visa breaches, we're going to create preventative detention regimes for the extreme cases. Like, they could have artfully dealt with this cohort and kind of relieved the pressure, but we're now doing it after the event when it's highly politicised, you know.
And they could have just given them spook powers, right? Like, you're in this category, you can be monitored. Your phone, your telecommunications can be monitored, things like that, just quietly, right? Mm. Nobody needs to know. And then if somebody's all of a sudden arranging some terrorist act, or they're getting drunk all the time or something,
or drug dealing or whatever it is,
you pick that up because you're monitoring them and then you charge them. The migration and other legislation amendment, bridging visas, serious offenders and other measures Act 2023 was passed not long after the previous act was passed. And this introduces a few additional charges or sort of offences, punishment for contacting victims in breach of visa conditions, for where people have committed crimes that have victims and so on, working in breach of visa conditions where the conditions on these visas is not to work, And it amends both the Crimes Act. It inserts part IAABA into the Crimes Act. I just wanted to say that because it's a ridiculous Commonwealth drafting. It also introduces...
It's time to revise the Federal Crimes Act.
Yeah, community safety orders into part 9.10 of the Criminal Code. And basically this covers people who have, in this category, they can't be taken anywhere out of Australia, they don't have a visa, and they pose a quote-unquote unacceptable risk of committing serious violent or sexual offences.
And how is that defined?
So there are there are both foreign and
domestic,
but in short, it's an offence that's punishable by life or for a maximum of at least 7 years, and...
That's pretty low.
7 years.
Yeah, but involves a loss of a person's life or a serious risk of a loss of a person's life.
Okay, that
interestingly, that last category, a loss of a person's life, has been held in some New South Wales high risk. You could get the flavour out of some HRO cases that an assault occasioning might give rise to the risk of a loss of a person's life, like a one-punch manslaughter. Like
punch in the head.
Yeah. Now, I can't, but there's assault occasioning five or seven, haven't we?
Five. Had this debate? Five. In company, so is seven.
Well, there you go.
Theft.
Yeah, that was about theft, wasn't it? That's right.
Felicity's great moment in the sun.
Sexual assault.
Some listeners will remember.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. sexual assault, child porn, some child acts, and so on. So it's if that conduct is of that kind in Australia or of that kind in a foreign place that would be of the kind in Australia, it's covered by that, right? Basically, if you've done an offence of that, if you've committed an offence of that kind
already,
if you haven't committed that offence, it doesn't apply to you if you've never done anything like that. But if you have and there's no real prospect of your removal and you're 18, then you can be detained, quote-unquote, in a prison for up to 3 years at a time.
In a prison?
Similar to the state right
This then. Can occur even if you're living at in the community at the moment, or it can occur if you're already in prison. So, for example, you're about to be given parole, they can apply for one of these orders to keep you in.
Why in prison?
Where else are you going to do it?
Well, I suppose the federal detention system.
The immigration detention centre.
Yeah.
The feds want them out of there, I guess.
Well, that's interesting. It does say in a... Now, there is a provision that says something like, they have to treat... So 395.7 of the code... a serious offender who's detained in custody in a prison under community safe detention order must be treated in a way that is appropriate to the offender's status as a person who is not serving a sentence of imprisonment, subject to any reasonable requirements necessary to maintain the security and good order of the prison, the safe custody or welfare of offender or any prisoners and so on. The offender must not be accommodated or detained in the same area or unit of a prison as persons who are imprisoned for the purposes of serving periods of imprisonment.
Unless.
Et cetera, right? And what I just said.
Practical anyway.
So in practical speaking, they will be kept.
Well, they might be in remand jails, I suppose.
Well, that's even worse.
That's the exact same. Right?
It's even worse.
Yeah. The same scenario, barring the party.
In fact,
you're going to end up... They're all together and then they end up,
Holy shit, I mean...
But you'd rather be in a sentence prisoner's part.
You would.
Oh, my God, that's right.
It's generally better. The remand jails are generally maximum, aren't they?
And generally, they are more chaotic. And people are coming in and going all the time. And
people classify people over time, so you start off...
Yeah. And this is just what happens when you rush legislation through. Serving sentences of imprisonment, people in remand jails are generally not doing that, so... Anyway, so what are the basis for the orders? The immigration minister can apply. It works like the high-risk offender scheme. There's a prelim hearing
A lot of work. Should have just done your suggestion.
Would have been a hell of a lot cheaper.
Unbelievable.
Prelim hearing to see whether experts... question is, are they likely to assist the court in deciding whether to make an order?
All these dodgy statistical analyses of risk will come to the fore again.
What's the phrase they use? There's some dodge that's used to pretend that they're not statistical analysis. I can't remember what the language is. But anyway, all these rubbish things that they use to tell the future, you know. Interestingly, it provides for self-incrimination for things that they say. Again, so you can't – that you can say things to them like, you know, I planned on blowing up the Harbour Bridge, and that can't be used against you, which is quite interesting.
In the risk assessment stuff?
In the risk assessment stuff. So the state legislature doesn't provide for that, which I thought was good. The test is bloody interesting. And I didn't get a chance to go back and look at whether it's the same test in the Commonwealth terror laws. It's different to the state one. So it's having regard to a series of matters which you'd expect, crim history, what the sentencing judge thought, all those sorts of things, the reports. The court is satisfied to a high degree of probability on the basis of admissible evidence that the offender poses an unacceptable risk of seriously harming the community by committing a serious violent or sexual offence. Now, that's different to the state regime, say, where the test is the person poses an unacceptable risk of committing a sexual offence because it's focused on harm to the community. So
through the commission of an offence.
Well, yeah, but it's going to lead to a whole bunch of really distasteful arguments about whether a person, say, who's likely to commit a serious assault is likely to seriously harm the community.
I wonder whether
by engaging in that assault.
But I wonder whether the courts might say, no, what that means is it deems serious harm to the community if you're at the requisite degree of risk of committing the offence.
Well, I mean, you can almost guarantee that's where they're going to land, but it's bloody arguable.
I wonder why they just didn't pick up the state tests.
Well, I think maybe
it's a bit simpler, isn't
maybe
it?
It's got to do with the empowering the Commonwealth government to make these orders. So I don't know that the Commonwealth government has a constitutional power to imprison people because they have a risk to the community. Sorry,
risk
of committing
offence. They've got a power over aliens, though, don't they? The aliens' power, right?
Aliens. So the aliens' power would permit them to. Well, I don't know. I'm guessing that this is some way to tie it back to the aliens' power, right? Yeah. Or it may just be rubbish drafting. Who knows? But I suspect that those words are added in because they want to tie. And I haven't checked the terror. It may be the same in the Commonwealth terror things, but it's interesting. So it's not the risk of a sexual offence being committed. It's the risk that offence will seriously harm the community. Now, every sexual offence will harm the community. So if you read that on the face of it, it has to be something more than that. It has to be – so it'd be interesting.
What are the terror laws justified under in terms of the constitutional provision? Is that the defence power?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's the defence power, isn't it? Whereas you couldn't tie this to the defence power because this is just individual people that pose a kind of criminal law risk.
Yeah. And so then there's a, if they're not satisfied of that or they're satisfied that some lesser measure can be done, then the court can impose conditions much the same as they do in the HRO regimes. They, you know, all kinds of conditions.
Minimum 64 conditions with subparagraphs.
So that's
wildly unreasonable as a regime.
I think that the jailing on the basis of – I have a complete objection to the jailing your people on the basis of risk. I think it brings courts into disrepute to engage in it. I think that it's not possible to assess the risk of any person committing an offence on the basis of expert reports or anything. I think – I really think
– it degrades our society, I think, to lock people up in that way.
But is there a heightened rationale when they're an alien who you can't remove?
No.
I don't really think so.
As I say,
it's still a human being.
The cost of doing this.
I know.
And it's not a crime to
something, right?
Like, it's not a crime to like seek asylum or
it's not
migrate.
But it is if you say are a war criminal who's come here to hide. Like,
I mean, none of these all these people are refugees.
No, I know.
Some are refugees, though.
And, you know, if you come here as a refugee and you commit child sex offences, the community might say, we don't really want you here.
But Jim, what's your thoughts?
I think, justified
to indefinitely, well, not indefinitely, but 3-year preventative detention regime.
But presumably they can just keep getting them.
Is that more justified? Forever.
Yeah, no, so it can be indefinite.
It should be the discretion of the, look, if you're going to rush through legislation that puts sort of criminal, this is my opinion. It's going to put, you know, the onus on judges to make calls and then go back on Sky News and say, we've put in these regimes in place. I guess you have that parliamentary discretion to do that. I'm against the mandatory minimum angle, just against it. That's my point of view.
Mm.
I mean, what else are you going to do? You're batting away Peter Dutton. You're batting away Sky News. You're batting away the Murdoch press. I just don't think it's thoughtful law reform.
I don't think the courts – I think the courts look really bad – trying to predict the future such that it deprives them of their sort of rational character, right? Because you can't predict the future. And the ones that you let out, there's going to be one. There's always going to be one who you let out that commits a horrible crime.
Doesn't the criminal law look, right? I mean, that's what it's in place to do. It governs us all. We're all governed by it.
And have we become so weak as a society? Like every individual crime is a tragedy, particularly the serious crimes that we're talking about.
Yeah.
But have we become so weak as a society that we say people who might commit crimes need to be locked up? And maybe we have.
That's where I really struggle, because I think that a society that does that actually creates more problems and makes the society less safe.
Well, that's definitely true sometimes. But sometimes, like, there are certain offenders, right, who dealing with them in a particular way is criminogenic and is going to cause more offending. But that's not necessarily so of any particular individual. And there might be a heightened rationale here when someone's an alien. I just struggle with the idea that you're an alien, you can't be removed. You just treat it like everyone else when it comes to risk factors.
This is where Emmanuel's argument comes in.
Maybe that's really unprincipled. I don't know. But
this
law strikes me as less draconian than the law that criminalises breach of visa conditions.
Well, I mean, the breach of visa conditions not even based on any kind of risk analysis or anything. I mean, it's got a reasonable excuse defence carve out, but it's the imposition of the conditions and the criminalisation of the breach is just in a complete vacuum in relation to risk, right? It's not.
My problem is the courts engaging in risk analysis of the likelihood of the commission of offence.
It's not their job.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
I'm in favour of your argument at the first instance where you said, the government was playing whack-a-mole the first week after, because the opposition and the news are saying there was a guy in Adelaide, he was one of the 100 cohort, and he's committed an offence down there, and they're like, oh, shit. So essentially, it's intelligence. These are intelligence gathering matters. There needs to be regimes in place to fight it covertly.
Yeah.
And it's not the court's job.
No, it's an executive function to protect us from people who might put our lives at risk, and outsourcing that to the court brings the court into disrepute. And I mean, I'm hopeful that we get some sort of strengthening of the limb principle in light of this decision.
I mean, to look at that argument through the constitutional sort of prism, so this decision says the law is unconstitutional because it's the executive detaining for a judicial purpose.
Yeah.
What you're saying is sort of the other argument, isn't it? Which is when you bring the courts into it, so you avoid the problem of executive detention being unconstitutional, you bring the courts into it.
Trying to cloak it with legitimacy of the courts, and that but actually you're making the courts illegitimate.
Like the cable, I think, is this the cable principle? That
you can't
a court with a function that undermines the legitimacy of the court.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it really, and you know, the...
But that's arguments failed, right, in respect to these state regimes.
Well, yeah, but I think it's Justice Gates, Chief Justice now, but when I think he wrote some dissents where he says basically, like, All right. Well, we said in Farden that you can have preventative detention.
Yeah.
But since then, what's been happening is the legislatures have just been slicing away more and more at that. And we're really at a place now in New South Wales, for example, where the court is forced to accept the evidence of an expert of a tool that has absolutely no basis, couldn't be tendered in any other kind of matter, and is it forced at first at the preliminary hearing to detain somebody on the basis that that expert report is correct. And that is somehow not bringing the court into disrepute.
But that happens in criminal sentencing, right? Because risk assessment is a factor in criminal sentencing, right? The risk you pose to the community, how much specific deterrence is needed, how much preventative detention is needed. Yep. That doesn't undermine the legitimacy of the courts, right? So why is it different when you take it outside the prism like of just deserts for criminal offending?
Because that risk assessment has occurred in the context of the sentence being imposed, right? So now we get into the point where we're doing, this person hasn't committed an offence and the only basis for detaining them is a predictive, right?
Exercise.
And other thresholds, like prior offending.
But there's no further detention warranted for punitive reasons, right? And so, given that it's forward-looking, and again, the other thing is that the courts in those cases are doing it beyond reasonable doubt as to every aggravating factor.
Mm.
And here we've got this amorphous standard,
lower standard.
Risk to the community, risk of committing a serious offence. It's just hearings that take a day.
And, I know. The consequences of the orders in those proceedings are often much more severe than the consequences of a sentence hearing orders. And yet that happens off the back of either a plea of guilty or a contested trial where the evidence has had to be proved beyond reasonable doubt and aggravating factors beyond reasonable doubt, etc. But yeah, as you said, Manny, these high-risk offender matters are just churned through the Supreme Court half a day, and they often have consequences which go far beyond the consequences of the earlier criminal determinations in some ways.
And it's so hard on the judges.
Yeah.
Who you bold up these – and, you know, if it's a constantly taken to minimise the amount of work that it takes. But the truth is, if you're going to decide whether or not to jail someone for 3 years, I've had local court hearings that have run for 15 days to decide whether or not someone should do 6 months. Now, if we're talking about someone who's come to the end of their sentence and we're going to decide that in 4 hours, that's just outrageous. And – I have a problem. I think it brings the court into dispute, and I think
I tend to agree.
You know, if
all of that said, there is some people that you can pretty accurately predict they're offending. I think
there's no doubt in my mind. I've done a lot of this work. There are people who I am sure would come out and offend if they weren't locked up.
Definitely,
right?
Yeah.
But that problem is partly an executive problem in the sense of they can go and monitor them anyway, and a rehabilitation problem. They can force the rehabilitation. And for those – so then we're getting down to some –
also mental health problem, right?
Mental health problem.
I'm not proposing this as a policy, but if you take an expanded definition of mental ill health to include very serious personality disorders, I mean, you could, I think, create – a detention regime that is based on risk of harm to self or others, which is an orthodox basis to detain at the moment, and apply it probably to almost all of the same people. I mean, most of the people being detained under these state regimes probably have antisocial personality disorder or some other clinical condition. I mean, is that your experience running these matters? More straightforward mental health
issues? Of course. I did a terrorist case this year called Richardson, where experts were appointed, and the psychiatrist expert said in no uncertain terms that he needed to be scheduled.
Yeah.
Right? And what does the state do? They press on with the terrorist application and don't even have him scheduled. They don't even attempt to have him scheduled, right? And it's like there's this entire mental health regime that could be applied, but instead you create these regimes and they are applied. And again, it's the problem of the legislature saying we need to do something.
We don't want to use a therapeutic regime. We want to use a punitive regime.
It's not even that. It's like they don't – it's like – I don't know. It's the executive government, by which I mean the bureaucracy, seems to be no longer trusted by the legislature to do – to manage issues like this. So were they given extra powers with curial approval to do it? Like,
I think no one wants to be responsible for that one case that you talk about, Manny, where, you know, someone is in the community and they commit a serious offence and someone's made that decision for them to be in the community.
Yeah.
So that's why they've said, okay, Supreme Court, you can do our dirty business. We'll sheet that all home to you and you have to make the hard decision about whether to lock someone up or put them on these extended supervision orders, and that way we can say, well, we set up this regime, you know, for high-risk offenders and the Supreme Court operates it, and so we made the application.
Yeah. I think courts and parliament should be saying to people, to the community, that whilst we do our abject best to protect you, we are not able to protect you from every single risk that you face in your life. If you've got a problem with that, talk to the executive government who's got the resources and things to do what they can. But we are not going to engage in predictive exercises that might mean that your son or daughter or a refugee finds themselves locked up even though they're never going to do anything wrong in their life.
Mm. Can I, as a footnote to this discussion, just refer our listeners to the Australian Public Law blog piece by Laura John, Josephine Langbian and Sanmati Verma, Liberty, Punishment and the Power to Detain, the Fallout from NZYQ and Minister for Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs. It's a really good piece that sort of goes through the different issues of the judgment and also then the kind of fallout that we've been talking about in terms of the legislation that's been passed since.
Thanks for listening. Please like The Wigs on Facebook at The Wigs Podcast. Don't forget to rate and review on iTunes.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, produced by Jim Mintz.